Right, I'm going to talk about some aspects of boycotts from an ethical point of view. And what I was originally going to do was talk about what situations actually make boycotts ethically justifiable, or indeed compulsory, I suppose, from a moral point of view. But having thought about it for a bit, I'm not sure that there is an ethics of boycotts, and I'm going to explain why I think that is. Boycotts are usually treated, and divestment and sanctions, as connected to punishment. I mean, from a moral point of view, they seem like they're designed to punish a guilty party, or they're designed to play some role in writing a balance which has become in some ways negative. I mean, that's how we often see punishment. And philosophers tend to apply two different ways of looking at punishment. One is in terms of the consequences. You punish somebody in order to bring about better consequences as a result of what you do. But another way of justifying punishment is in terms of the actual character of the wrong which has to be righted. So there has to be a balance between rights and wrongs. And you're not actually after a particular result. And one of the interesting things about the debate over boycotts and sanctions is that these two justifications for punishment tend to be merged and confused often. But they are actually quite distinct. I mean, it's very important for those who see punishment as being based upon results that you actually assess very carefully what the results of the proposed action are going to be. And we've heard that a lot over the last 3 days. People have said quite often that sanctions and boycotts haven't, on the whole, been terribly effective in practical terms, in bringing about the sorts of changes which they're designed to bring about. But from the other notion of punishment as being retributive, that's not important, because the important thing is that you punish not in order to bring about a better result from a practical point of view, but to mark a wrong which needs to be righted. And the wrong needs to be righted, whatever the consequences, as retributivists often say. I mean, punishment is often symbolic. It symbolizes society's attitude, or a group in society's attitude, to something which has been done which is regarded as wrong. And I think that's the significance of the BDS movement. And I mean, I think the BDS movement has gone from strength to strength, rightly or wrongly, because it has managed to label policies of Israel in negative ways, which, it, in my view, will increasingly capture the public's imagination and make life harder for Israel ideologically, probably not in the practical terms, but ideologically. And that's, as Ehud Barak suggested, it is not a good position to be in. But I know absolutely nothing, as I'm sure my talk will provide you with excellent evidence of. I know absolutely nothing about politics. I'm just going to talk about some of the philosophical issues which arise here. And one of the things which it seems to me one shouldn't do, although in the previous panel people did it, it's very difficult to compare different cases. Apartheid, South Africa, Israel today, the former Soviet Union, Namibia, you know, the Central African Empire as it was, now a republic, whatever. I mean, it's very, very difficult to compare different countries. What David called, when he started, introduced the whole conference, whataboutery. You know, where somebody says, oh, you know, we've really got to punish Israel for doing X, Y, and Z, or Z. And then somebody said, yeah, but what about such and such a country? I mean, nobody is not many people are demonstrating against terrible things which are going on in other countries, which really often seem to be much worse than some of the terrible things which go on in Israel or Palestine. I don't think that's a very good argument. I mean, it from a logical point of view, and Lee used the interesting expression moral consistency, the idea that if something is very wrong in a particular country, and we agree it's very wrong, and if another country looks rather like the first country, then to be morally consistent, we have to condemn both countries. I'm not sure that's right, though, because it seems to me one can only really be expected to take an interest in a limited number of situations. You can only really be expected to know and understand the details of countries which are close to you in some way. I mean, of course, we know a lot more about some countries than about other countries, depending on who we are. I mean, we're closer to some countries, we're closer to some people than to other people. I was reading in the newspaper today that the tennis player, Murray, who won Queen's, gave his prize money to the Royal Marsden Hospital. Why did he give his prize money to the Royal Marsden Hospital? Because he has a friend in there undergoing treatment. Now, is the Royal Marsden Hospital any better than any other hospital? I mean, could we say to Andy Murray, you should have given your money to the Great Ormond Street Hospital, or to the Middlesex Hospital, or to any other charity? Okay. Too late. See, had he given the money, maybe it would have still be there. But I mean, what about such and such? If I want to give my money to a particular charity, can another charity with justification say to me, no, I mean, it's not fair that you give it to this charity. You should at least give some of it to us. It strikes me that you can't say that. I mean, moral consistency does not involve being completely dispassionate in how you disperse your charity. And similarly, in political terms, it seems to me that moral consistency does not imply that you have to treat every country the same. There are certain countries we can be expected to know about in the same way that there are certain people we can be expected to know about. Charles Dickens in, I think, Bleak House has the Jellabys. Mrs. Jellaby is fascinated with the improving the conditions of people in Africa, and she doesn't notice that her own family is falling apart. And I think Charles Dickens implies that Mrs. Jellaby should really direct some of her attention to what's going on in her own home, rather than being involved in some project, you know, thousands of miles away. But this does bring out an aspect of, you know, this sort of political campaigning which is involved in boycotts, which the previous speaker actually gave a good indication of when he talked about the pleasurable aspect. Because, you know, when you are involved in a boycott, for most of us, it's an enormous amount of fun. You know, you're part of a group. You meet people. You meet girls. You meet boys. There are parties. You know, you go on demonstrations. It's great fun, often. And, you know, what does it matter to us? I mean, I'm old enough to remember the demonstrations against South Africa. You know, there was no cost involved in going to those demonstrations. Well, occasionally somebody would get a police baton over your head or something like that. That wasn't fun, of course. But I mean, it was no cost to us, really, to be involved in those things. On the contrary, they were very fashionable. What's wrong with something being fashionable? I mean, what's wrong with going along with a fashionable cause if it's a lot of fun? And that made me wonder whether a boycott, I think BDS is becoming increasingly fashionable, which I think is why it will be increasingly successful. I don't think that's because of any particular merit about it, but it's a matter of what people find they're interested in. I mean, I'm old enough to remember, I'm a child, as you can tell by looking at me, I'm a geriatric hippie, but I remember the 60s. In the 60s, we were all fascinated with Vietnam and America's involvement in Vietnam. Was that the worst thing that ever happened to humanity? No. Was that even the worst thing that was going on in the 60s and 70s? Not really. But that was the fashionable issue.
I'm asking that question.
I mean, was it the worst thing? There was the Soviet Union and the repression that was going on. All sorts of terrible things were going on in China, famine, starvation, murders of maybe millions of people. I mean, Vietnam was not a good thing. I was very much involved in campaigning against it, but it was a fashionable cause of the time. And the question, well, what about China, or what about the Soviet Union, or what about all these other places, really isn't that relevant, because aren't we allowed to pick our causes? If there is injustice going on somewhere, aren't we allowed to boycott or try to punish the country which we think is being unjust? Here again, we have to be careful. I mean, because there's a tendency to regard the BDS movement as being, you know, connected in some ways to anti-Semitism, or potentially connected to anti-Semitism. And certainly, it's quite possible that some people's motivation for criticizing a country might be based on their negative attitudes towards the people who constitute the majority in that country, or the power base in that country. I mean, it's possible. But that doesn't show that it's wrong. I mean, that shows that your motivation is suspect. I mean, similarly, if I give my money to a charity worker who is attractive, and of course we give money more to attractive people than to people who are unattractive, it doesn't mean that I shouldn't give money. It just means that, you know, there is another explanation for why I'm doing something. So I don't think we should be that caught up with motivation here. Of course, if your involvement in a political campaign is only done on the basis because you dislike a particular group of people, that's a bad thing, of course. But it doesn't show that the aim of the project is in itself unjustified. I think that's quite an important point. How rational are boycotts? Now, we've heard a lot of debate about boycotts aren't terribly effective. You know, they don't do very much. I was reading in yesterday's City AM, towards the back, they have a whole list of fantastically successful Israeli companies in the dot-com business, you know, in that sort of technology, which Israel is so good at. And we know that Israel, the Israeli economy, in the last few years has been amazingly successful, regardless of whether hummus from Israel is allowed into a store in Brooklyn. You know, we know that that's not very important. So, you know, it doesn't have an enormous effect, perhaps, in the sense of the material consequences, but it does have a big effect in terms of stigmatizing, in terms of challenging practices, challenging attitudes. I mean, and that is a form of punishment which in some ways is symbolic, but it does something to strike at the heart of the policy which you're trying to counter. And it also provides you with a lot of entertainment. You know, you meet, as I say, it provides you with a social network. And what's wrong with that? So in some ways, it seems to me that boycotts don't have an ethical basis so much as an aesthetic basis. it's a bit like supporting a football team or liking a particular form of music. I mean, it's acceptable insofar as one is justified in criticizing a particular form of government or a particular sort of organization, as long as one can find, and what government does not have something wrong connected with it, either today or in the past? I mean, what country anywhere in the world has not done something of which it ought to be ashamed, either now or in the past? You know, what country, however, you know, perfect it looks or however nice it looks, has not got skeletons in the closet which somebody may decide they're going to, you know, be critical of? And if that's the case, then it seems to me that any country could be boycotted quite legitimately. And you could say, I mean, when I'm in England, I have an allotment in East London, and my neighbor has been boycotted by all the other allotment holders because he chopped down a tree on his allotment, which is not only forbidden, but it's strictly forbidden by the rules, and nobody now talks to him. But he's my neighbor, and he's also he lives near me also. He lives near me also in my house. So should I also boycott him? Well, I mean, it seems to me an interesting question. He did something very wrong. He chopped down a tree. But should I boycott him? Perhaps. I mean, it's a decision. I could boycott him. There would be nothing wrong in boycotting him. But it seems to me the sort of decision which could go either way. It doesn't really matter, ethically, what I do. I might decide to, I might decide not to. And that's how boycotts, I think, you know, we talk about this great moral, we address it as though it were a great moral issue of huge controversy. But I don't think it is. I think it's much more, something we should be much more relaxed about. It doesn't have enormous consequences. And, you know, we should acknowledge that and put boycotts, sanctions, and divestment in their appropriate place. So I've come to the time when I ought to stop. I'm going to say one more thing, and then I really will stop. Are boycotts a matter of punishment? If they are a matter of punishment, as I've suggested, people often talk about them as a matter of punishment, then this sort of way of looking at them might perhaps be worth considering. If they're not a form of punishment, then we ought to discuss much more precisely what exactly they are. And, you know, that if there's one weakness in many of the discussions so far, it's that we talk about boycotts as though we know exactly what they are. And I don't think we do know exactly what they are. You know, a lot of action is symbolic rather than practical. And then it becomes quite mysterious as to what's going on. So I think we do need to think a bit more about what we actually mean by a boycott. And it's probably gone a long way from 19th century Ireland and how the boycott language and ideology has come to be part of our cultural system. And on that note, I will stop. Thank you very much, and I look forward to responding.